And welcome into Studio 2. Hello, everybody. I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Later on today's show, the Slow AF Run Club. Writer Martinez Evans was told he could either start exercising or suffer as his health went downhill. Weighing in at over 300 pounds, he chose to run. Do you have any questions about running for people of all body types? You can email us at studio2@whyy.org.
And then later in the hour, we're going to talk about paleontology. Why? Well, it's been 30 years since Jurassic Park opened in theaters and changed that scientific field forever. But before we get to all of that, we want to update you on the story that is on everybody's mind today, Cherry.
Yes, that shooting in the Kingsessing neighborhood. It dominated my social media timeline for the 4th of July and made national news. We'll go deeper in a few minutes during our newsmaker interview with Councilmember Jamie Gauthier. But here's what we know so far, Avi. 5 people dead, 2 people wounded in that Monday night shooting. The 2 wounded were 2 years old and 13 years old. They were shot in the legs. A sibling of the 2-year-old and his mother were hurt by flying glass. It all started around 8:28 p.m. in the 1600 block of South 56th Street, where one person was found dead at a property. And the shooter's name is Kimbrady Carricker, 40 years old, of Philadelphia. That person was arrested Monday night, is now in custody. They are arraigned on 11 charges, including murder, aggravated assault, and reckless endangerment. And it appears at this point, Avi, that the shooter acted randomly.
Yeah. So many thoughts running through all of our minds over the last 24, 48 hours trying to process this. One of the sobering thoughts was we knew we would do a story like this
right
at some
around
point.
This. Yeah.
You know, it was going to happen in our region. Sadly, I don't want to be too doomer about it, but we'll probably do a story like this again. I mean, we're going to talk with a local politician about potential solutions, but one of the problems is that local politicians are handcuffed in many ways.
Yeah.
We believe this shooter, again, alleged shooter, we should be clear, Kimbrady Carricker, had, you know, more or less a weapon of war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, there's a lot we don't know, and we're trying not to speculate too much. I hate that one of my thoughts was that it could have been worse.
Yeah.
But that was one of my thoughts. The police, from what we know, were able to apprehend this person in an alleyway without any further damage, without anyone else being shot. So those are just some of the thoughts going through my mind. They're not happy thoughts. And we're all just trying to process this right now. And like we said, we will talk with Councilmember Jamie Gauthier in a few minutes.
Yeah. And I want to just take a moment to send prayers to the families of the 5 people who died, 5 men. We'll tell you more about what we know about them later on, but you know, this is a lot. 29 mass shootings this year with 4 or more deaths, 346 shootings with 4 or more people injured. And that's just this year. 11 mass shootings just in the month of July. And we're only 5 days in.
Yep. You know, obviously, we were all finding about this incident in real time.
Yeah.
Sort of late night, the 3rd, and then early on the 4th. And, you know, a lot of us were using Twitter.
Twitter, yeah.
Twitter,
I know, that's how
we joke about Twitter a lot because it is in some ways sort of a laughable platform, or has become a laughable platform in recent months. But it is, to its credit, the best way to find information in real time. I don't want to say it's an indispensable part of our jobs, Cherry, but
yeah.
I will admit, if you want to peek behind the curtain, when we're doing newscasts, local news,
Twitter
is up. And not just, it's not a simple version of Twitter. It's the most complicated version with all sorts of columns and different, we're monitoring all sorts of different things because it has become the real-time communications platform. But it has basically started to fall apart.
Yeah.
Let's be realistic about this. And it does correspond with the ownership of Elon Musk. It has become much harder to use. A lot of the programs that we used to display Twitter have been curtailed or put behind paywalls.
Yeah.
And we're all trying to figure out how to use this thing moving forward. And some alternatives have popped up. I know we wanted to talk about a little bit today.
Well, one alternative is Spill. It was created by former Twitter employees, Alfonso Fons Terrell and Devaris Brown. They've collaborated with some Black creatives to create this other platform. I downloaded the app. I'm now on the wait list.
The waiting list,
but
right.
There are others like Blue Sky, Mastodon. They both have, you know, people have seen an uptick in users recently. And I should mention that last week, Twitter limited the number of tweets you could view today to 600. And this, of course, sparked another mass exodus.
Yeah.
Folks trying to find alternatives. And one very viable one is Threads, a Meta program.
So that's going to come out tomorrow.
Yeah.
And so Meta, which owns Facebook, is launching its version of Twitter now. Obviously, the other corporations see an opportunity here to try to steal user share away from Twitter. What makes Twitter work is the fact that all of the newsmakers and newsbreakers are on it simultaneously. So when you fracture the audience, none of these things are as useful as Twitter. So the question is there going to be one winner here that we all end up gravitating toward that we can all use? And like I said, it's not like we can't do our jobs without it. But if you work in this business, having a real-time information platform that everyone uses simultaneously is a humongous tool. And I just hope, I mean, put aside Elon Musk, put aside Mark Zuckerberg. I don't care about these people, frankly. I do care that we can stay connected in a way that allows us to accurately and quickly report the news.
And I think we got to mention, I've been on Twitter since 2009. That's 14 years of commitment.
Oh, gosh.
And so you think about, like, people are going to lose years, more than a decade of time of building up, you know, knowledge and audience and all that thing. And so people wanted to work out. But the other things people want to work out, the budget. Governor Josh Shapiro and the Republican-controlled Senate, they cannot seem to find common ground. The result is the state budget is late. The deadline was June 30th. Right now, the House is planning a voting session for today. And the Senate has yet to schedule their return to Harrisburg. The consequences, well, the Commonwealth can still operate right now without a plan. But schools and libraries could face some budget issues if they don't solve this.
Fourth time in the last decade that the budget has been late. Not a new thing. You know, there was a big, big budget impasse in Tom Wolf's first year as governor. And, you know, people thought it was going to hurt him in the long run politically. And it didn't. He won re-election easily. So we'll see what happens here. We're going to dig into this topic a little bit more in the coming days, probably as this resolves. But it's just something we're keeping our eye on. Now we want to transition to our newsmaker interview today. We talked a few minutes ago about the shooting that happened late Monday in the King Sessing neighborhood of Southwest Philadelphia. Councilmember Jamie Gautier represents the district where the mass shooting occurred and joins us now on the line. Councilmember, we wish it was under different circumstances, but thank you for joining us on Studio 2.
Thank you for having me, and I wish it were different as well.
So we want to start with just your reaction to this shooting and just how your constituents right now are feeling given all that has occurred.
It was just a shocking, unbelievable act of violence, terrifying. And my heart goes out to all of the families and people who were impacted, and really the whole community, because when something like this happens, it's almost impossible to feel safe where you live, and no one should have to feel like that in Philadelphia. So I think people will be healing from this, the families as well as the broader community, for some time.
What questions do you have right now? Because you're not in the investigatory role here. You're like us. You're waiting for information. What are the questions on the top of your mind?
I think the questions that, you know, are in my mind are the ones that, you know, I've been trying to answer for the past several years. How can we stop gun violence in our communities? How can we make our communities safe again, particularly communities like King Sessing that have just dealt with an extraordinary amount of violence in the last 3 years in particular? And so with this instance, I have questions about how a citizen can get their hands on weapons of war, essentially, right? How someone who seems to have been dealing with or is dealing with mental health issues can get their hands on a gun, period, much less an AR assault rifle and multiple magazines and kind of all of the equipment that, that they were working with. And I think that we have to be working on multiple fronts to stop this type of gun violence from happening and to stop the everyday gun violence that, Black communities in particular in Southwest Philadelphia and beyond are experiencing. We should be trying to prevent any way that a community, that our communities are being terrorized, including what happened on Monday.
And so, council member, I just want to talk about, I know the city of Philadelphia has been pumping a lot of money into gun violence prevention programs, but when we heard the mayor speak, he's calling on Congress, he's calling on state lawmakers. I want to talk about what frustrates you more, the most, when you're dealing with this issue, especially when you are a local lawmaker and there's so much, there's not much you can do or this political body that you're a part of can actually do?
You know, certainly I agree with the mayor's comments that in this example, this is an example of how people getting their hands on, you know, high-powered assault weapons and instruments of war has disastrous results for our communities. And, you know, he's right that locally we're preempted from dealing with that issue. That's an issue where we need help from the state and the federal government. We need political courage. We need people to care about what's happening in these communities enough to act to help us on the ground make it safer in Philadelphia. However, I also believe, and as we've seen, that gun violence takes many, many, many different forms. And so while we don't see the sort of randomized event that we saw on Monday as much, in communities across Philadelphia, we're having, you know, gun violence that's related to a street group activity, that's related to drug sales and drug activity that's just happening through, you know, arguments that escalate and turn into violence. And that we have to be working to address all of those fronts. And there are a lot of things I believe that we could do locally to impact, you know, the violence that we're seeing on a regular basis. I don't believe we should be helpless. I don't believe we should be helpless in terms of what we are seeing every day here in Philadelphia. And I believe that we have to call our state and federal partners to task to help us, you know, bring safety to our communities again.
So just to clarify that point, you feel as a local lawmaker, there is something you can do to curtail the violence that erupts from personal disagreements and rivalries, but you feel like it's quite difficult to do anything about what this incident seems to have been, which is someone acquiring a very high-powered weapon and shooting randomly at people. You feel that council, there isn't much council can do about that.
I feel that and know that council doesn't have direct control over that issue. But even as a local lawmaker, you have to find avenues, to try to make things happen, right? That doesn't mean that we give up. That means that we advocate, because we don't have the, you know, local control. That means that we partner, with the entities that do have, that control. But no, we don't have direct control over the, you know, the gun laws in the state. And so we definitely need action from Harrisburg and we need action from, the federal government. And I hope that they hear us. I do think, as it relates to mental health, there is a lot that we can do. And that seems to be another aspect of what was happening here.
Yeah. And as we wrap up, I want you to just talk about any support services that you are hoping you have about 30 seconds the city can provide to folks, because everybody who was there or connected to that incident, probably a little traumatized.
Yeah, definitely. So I know that there was a group from the district attorney's office that went out the day after the incident to connect people to trauma services. I'm going to be following up to make sure that the families and the people who live on the block more broadly have access to those services. But I also think that coming out of the pandemic, a lot of people are dealing with unaddressed mental health issues in our communities. Yeah. And we need accessible, culturally competent mental health services.
We'll have to leave it there. We'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much. That was Councilmember Jamie Gaultier. Thank you for joining us on Studio 2.
Thank you.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Transitioning now, Cherry, got to ask you a question. Are you a runner?
Absolutely not. But I'm a walker, though. I have shoes. I have 2-pound weights, all of that. Yeah. So
walking with weights. Okay. That's something.
Fast walking.
Fast walking. Okay. No, I respect that. I've tried to run a little bit on and off over the years. I'll admit I don't like it as a form of exercise, but it's the easiest way to try to get some form of exercise into your day because, you know, you start where you finish type of thing at your own house. But that's why I'm excited to talk to our next guest, Martinez Evans, who says lots of people are turned off from running because it's hard and it's painful and they don't fit the runner image that the mass media has you sort of buy into, the slim, the athletic physique. You know what runners, quote unquote, look like.
Absolutely. And Evans does not fit that stereotype. He's 300 pounds and a former football player. He says he started running after a doctor told him, "You're fat. You have two options, either lose weight or die." So defiantly, he committed to running a marathon and kept a blog about his journey called 300 Pounds and Running.
And since then, Evans has run many marathons and started the Slow AF Run Club. I can't say what the ANF stands for on this family network, but you can imagine. It inspires people of all shapes, sizes, and athletic ability to run. And he's got a new book by the same name called Slow AF Run Club, The Ultimate Guide for Anyone Who Wants to Run. And we've got him on the line right now. Welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
And we're going to start this conversation, dive right in. Just a little note, we're having a slight issue with our phone lines and our email right now, so we can't take any questions from you listening right now. But don't worry, Cherry and I have got lots of questions lined up. And Cherry, why don't you start us off?
Absolutely. And so first of all, I'm so excited to have you here today, Martinez. And I just want us, you know, to start. Why did you write this book?
So, Cherry, I wrote this book because I was just frustrated with all of the running books out there. Most running books are written by elite athletes or coaches of elite athletes teaching you how to run fast. However, what I encountered running when I first started running, none of that information was useful to me. So by going through all of these years of running, I pretty much had to learn everything the hard way. And this is the same thing that happens with the people that I coach as well.
So the goal of your book is different than the typical running book. Like, because you read some of these running books and it's like how to trim 15 seconds off your mile or whatever. Your book is the goal is completely different.
Absolutely. The goal for this book is to get individuals off the couch, individuals who may feel like they're intimidated by the sport of running or anybody that's like, you know, I'm too old, too fat, too fill in the blank to be a runner. This is the book for them.
Yeah, I want to say the book covers everything you need to know from the basic level, from how to choose shoes, diet, safety. I want you to rewind back to the couch guy, the version of you that had this conversation with the doctor. Who were you then? Describe yourself.
So I was an ex-football player. I probably was done playing football about 2 or 3 years after that. It's actually working at Men's Warehouse. So I was on my feet 8 to 10 hours a day in hard bottom dress shoes, suited and booted. So I was on my feet, you know. So that was me. That was me. I was on my feet. I was still more or less a weekend warrior. So I would play basketball with friends or flag football, things of that sort. And I developed some hip issues because this was like a relatively new job. And who else, you know, of course you're going to have some type of hip or knee issues when you're on concrete floors and hard bottom dress shoes for 8 to 10 hours a day.
Yeah. And so you have this conversation with your doctor. What were the health issues that prompted him to say exercise or die?
So, Jerry, this is a very interesting question, right? So this is my first time meeting this doctor. So I went there because I was having some hip issues, right? You know, I was on my feet having some hip issues. So I went to this doctor to figure out what was going on with my hip. And one of the things that you find out being a person of size is that you can literally have your eyeball hanging out your head. And the doctor be like, you know what? That eye looks crazy, but let's talk about your weight first.
Oh, gosh.
And this is the same thing. I think this is the same thing that happened with me. You know, I'm sitting with this doctor and I'm sitting there and telling him, you know, my hip hurts. I used to be a football player. I'm on my feet, you know, just trying to give him up to speed up, like what I got going on in my life. And he didn't put a stethoscope on me. He ain't touch me or anything. He was just like, I know why you're in pain. I was like, well, tell me. And then he goes in this whole thing of you're fat, you need to lose weight or die. And I was more or less taken back.
Yeah.
Because this wasn't a doctor that I deal with on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
But B, because of this preconceived notion of what people of size, what they do. I guess he expected me to just be sitting on the couch eating ice cream with chips mixed in, right? But like I was on my feet, you know,
yeah.
I was literally on my feet 8 to 10 hours a day working this commission sales job.
So did you say that back to him, or like in that moment, were you just too stunned to talk?
So in that moment, I laughed. And then he went on to tell me, you know, you got this stomach as a pregnant woman. You need to start walking on a track, on and so forth. And, you know, you're just not going to continue to talk to me any type of way. So I was like, you know, skip all that. Like, I'll run a marathon, just being facetious, just being sarcastic and just trying to push back on just being irritated and annoyed by this doctor who's trying to put me down.
Mm.
And then he laughs at me and tells me that's the most stupidest thing he has heard in all his years of practicing medicine.
Wow.
And then I hope this guy was just having a bad day.
And you're like, challenge accepted.
Exactly.
Well, so, but one of the interesting things, though, is with your story, this is not the only part of your story or biography where you were sort of inspired by somebody basically being a jerk to you, right? Mm. Because the Slow AF label of your club, the Slow AF Run Club, that is something where you co-opted someone that was basically jeering you from the crowd, right? Can you tell that story?
Absolutely. I'll try to keep it PG-13.
Okay. Do your best, please. We don't have a live bleeper, just so you know.
I'll bleep myself. So I was running New York City Marathon. This is probably Marathon 2 or 3 at the time. And I'm in the back of the pack, and this gentleman is heckling me. And I remember taking off my headphones and he's pointing at me, and I'm like, yo, what's going on? And he's like, you're slow. You're slow as beep, and told me to go home.
Jesus.
So
heckles runners
I'm
in the New York Marathon? Who does
New
that?
Yorker.
Exactly. It's by far the most New York thing you can ever do. So I get into this argument with this guy, you know, because he got his beer in his hand. He's telling me I'm slow, and I'm like, you need to go home because you're drunk. And when I finished the race, because I did finish the race, I was like, you know what? I want to put Slow AF across my chest, just like the S on Superman. And this is a badge of honor to let people know that regardless if you're slow or in the back of the pack, you're doing the thing.
Yeah.
And you're doing it in spite of all the other obstacles that are in your way.
I think that's part of your story and your appeal is you take the power from the mean people and turn it into inspiration. Like, is that something you've always done in your life, or is that something you had to come to later? That thought of, I'm going to take this abuse and I'm actually going to use it, and I'm going to empower myself and others with it.
Oh, it's something that I've had all my life. You know, I grew up in the east side of Detroit in a single parent household. So, you know, there's so many struggles that you have to figure out how to turn a negative to a positive, or you just won't keep going.
Hmm.
One of the things you say in your book is you spend a lot of time on mindset. And one of the pieces of advice you tell folks is to be delusional. Can you talk about what it means in your mind to be delusional? Because given how you grew up, you had to turn negatives into positives. Is that sort of like the thread as well?
Absolutely. So practicing delusional self-belief. This is the notion that you have to believe in yourself so much and wed, and you're so wedded to your dreams that everybody else around you is delusional. So, you know, you think about the common things that I see around our house, the microphone, the light, the cell phone, right? Somebody had to come up with this idea, and imagine that person trying to go through this idea and come with it. And somebody being like, what do you mean you want to talk to somebody in another room or in another country and you hear, like, you're delusional. However, I'm talking to y'all right now through a microphone on a cell phone. So it's that notion of these ideas that you have in your head is impossible until they are possible. And you have to stick with it and roll with it and do the work to get there.
So building off that, I want you to give a pep talk to, let's imagine there's a listener out there who has always wanted to try to start running, but is scared and doesn't know where to start. What is the first thing you are saying to that listener?
All right, listener, you sitting on the couch, listen to me.
Here's the pep talk. Here we go.
It's not where you started, it's where you're going. Listen here, everybody has a day zero. Sometimes you may even have a multiple day zero. Mm. But what I want you to do is get outside, put your shoes on, and run to your first light pole. And then walk back home. Mm. And celebrate that. And if you don't have a light pole, start with 15 seconds. Run for 15 seconds. And then walk for a minute and a half. And then evaluate. Was that 15 seconds too much? Was it too little? If it's too little, let's make it 30 seconds. If it's too much, let's back it down to 10 seconds. And you're going to do that for 15 to 20 minutes. And then you're going to go home and you're going to celebrate yourself. And you're going to do that for 3 days a week. Hmm. And after you do that for 3 weeks, reevaluate. Is the running easy? Let's increase it. Is the walking too long? Let's decrease it. That's running in a sense. It's not where you started. It's really about where you're going.
I'm getting out of my chair right now.
I know. And I want to figure out what your, I mean, besides, you know, health and or whatever, what's your why? What keeps you sort of like motivated? And I say why specifically when it comes to running, because there's so many different forms of exercises, right, you could choose. Mm-hmm. So what's your why and specifically when it comes to running?
So when it comes to running, initially it was spite. It was the notion of this doctor told me I'm going to die if I run a marathon, and I'm going to prove I'm wrong. And I ran eight marathons since then. I think now my biggest why is to inspire the masses. So one of the things that we're doing with the Slow F Run Club, our largest mission is to inspire 1 million people to start running in the body that they have right now. And I think by me running and still running in this 300-pound body, by running marathons and a bunch of other races, when people see me, they see themselves and what the possibilities of their life can look like. And that's something I want to continue to give to the rest of this world.
If you're just joining us on Studio 2, we are talking with Martinez Evans, founder of the Slow AF Run Club and the author of a new book, Slow AF Run Club, The Ultimate Guide for Anyone Who Wants to Run. I want to talk about this online community that you have cultivated, whether it's, you know, through a podcast or Instagram. You've created kind of a world that is built around acceptance. And when I go online, I feel like the default way to get attention is either be mean or divisive. But you have done something that is neither and still obviously gotten a lot of attention. So how did you do that? And do you think there are people who are craving that on social media and just sort of not getting it?
Yes. I think that's the beautiful thing of the thing that I'm doing with Slow Your Front Club is that when you think about traditional marketing and diet culture, marketing is meant to make you feel bad.
Yeah.
You know what'll make you feel better about your life? This pill or this powder or whatever else, right? Mm-hmm. And the beautiful thing is that I'm promoting self-love. I'm promoting self-acceptance. And for most of these brands, you can't package up self-love and self-acceptance in a pill bottle or in a powder form to hawk off to people who don't need to stuff. So I think this is just a message that people have been waiting for a very long time, to say that you can be active. And you know what? Everyone should be active, even if they don't lose weight. You know, we for a very long time, we have this thing of weight loss and exercise is synonymous. Like, if you exercise, that will equate into weight loss. But there's so many other benefits that comes to regular physical activity. Your heart rate, your blood pressure, your A1Cs, all of that stuff still happens when you're being regularly physically active. Mm. And I think that's just the notion I want to tell people, is that I'm not here to beat you down. I want everybody to get off the couch. I want everybody to be active. And you should continue to be active regardless if you lose weight. And I think for the traditional message of diet culture, or, you know, what's traditionally out there, is that if you don't lose weight while you're exercising, you're a failure.
Yeah.
And my thing is like, no, you're not a failure. Continue to do this.
Yeah.
I think about being having a large body. You know, you have a larger body, 300 plus pounds or whatever, and you have to navigate this world and navigate now the running world. And it started off a little shaky, but you seem to have overcome that. What do you have to say for folks who don't fit the quote standard, you know, view of like the slim runner or whatever, and they want to get into athletics, and it may not necessarily be running, but just sort of like self-acceptance, knowing, you know, your body is what your body is.
Yeah, so this actually takes me back to the days when I was at Men's Warehouse, when individuals come in and say, hey, like, I'm this suit size. And I'm like, you know what? I can only fit you for a suit that your current body has right now. And I think that's the thing that you have to tell people, is that it don't matter what you was back in the past. It don't matter what you went through. It's right about now and doing what you can right now. It goes back to the whole notion of, it's not where you started. You might have multiple starting lines. It's about where you finish. We all are going to go through some type of adversity, and that's what makes us more than an athlete. That doesn't make us less than an athlete. Yeah. And I think for the traditional culture, it's like, oh, if you're not running fast, if you're not aiming for the finish line, then like, you're not an athlete. And basically what I'm saying is that no, as long as you're doing the things that A, provides a physical benefit, and you're getting better, even if it's 1% better every day, you are an athlete, because you still have to overcome a bunch of other obstacles just to even get to the start line.
I love that message, but boy, does it feel like you're paddling upstream a little bit, because there are so many, like, here's the thing. When people start to run, when they go on a diet, they want that reward. And oftentimes, and I've been in this place, the reward is the scale number goes down. And if it doesn't go down, you feel like a failure, because really the reward you're looking for is other people looking at you and being impressed, right? And I just, how can you maintain that type of attitude? Like, this isn't about the number on the scale. This isn't about the number on the scale. How do you actually maintain that, not for like a month, but for years and years and years and years?
Javier, I think, you know, we seek so much for external validation that we don't even know what inner self belief looks like.
Yeah.
And I think this is something that I want to empower individuals, is that the goal and the journey is not within external validation of people telling you you look good, or, you know, you look good and keep going. It comes within, right? So for me, I get the pleasure and enjoyment of running races and getting that medal at the end of the race. Mm. I get joy and pleasure out of running races and, you know, sitting next to, running next to a guy and be like, hey man, like, this is rough, right? And then he's like, yeah, this is rough, but you know what? We're going to finish this thing together.
Yeah.
Like, that's where I get joy and pleasure out of, versus somebody telling me, oh, you look good in that particular outfit. Because here's the thing. You don't know what that person had to do to even get there. Like, yeah, you're like, you celebrating that person. Like, oh, yeah, you look good. But you don't know if they have a eating disorder. You don't know what they're doing behind closed doors. Yeah. So, you know, I would rather just think about the things that I have internally and continue to flame that fire that I have internally to keep going and to continue to provide joy and inspiration to other individuals.
Yeah, I want to talk about a story you wrote about in your book about the bus. There's a bus that comes at the end of races to pick folks up, and you saw that bus one day. Could you tell us about the day you said no to the bus.
Oh, yeah. So this is my first marathon, Terry. I was running my first marathon. I was around mile 18. And I come in contact with, you know, they call it a sag wagon, which is which is like the support. You call it a paddy wagon, right?
They call it that. Oh, God.
Yeah, but SAG stands for like supporting gear. So they're supposed to like pick up people who are like either injured or pass out water and things of that sort. And this driver of this bus, he had a whole nother thing for me. So, you know, as I'm running, you know, he's like, hey, big man, like you want to ride to the finish line? And I'm like, no, I'm okay. And then mile 19, mile 20, mile 21, hey, big man, you want to ride to the finish line? Pretty much like taunting me to quit. And I think it's just a great allegory for like life is that you're going to be doing the thing. You're out there doing it. And there's going to be people that are going to want you to quit just because it's sport for them.
Can I ask you,
like,
this is a bit of a shift, but you posed naked for a magazine. It was Men's Health magazine, was it?
Yes.
Okay. Obviously, you have made tremendous strides with self-acceptance and understanding, you know, accepting your body. But posing naked for a magazine is like a whole nother level of comfort.
Next level.
I mean, was that a challenge for you? Did you have to sort of, was that a moment of confrontation internally for you? Or was it just like, hey, let's do it. I'm ready. Let's do it, Men's Health.
You know, I was ready.
You were ready. Go good. Great.
I was ready. I think they were more nervous to ask me whether or not I was going to pose nude than me being like, okay, I'll do it.
Yeah. What was their vibe?
You know, their thing was like, well, Martinez, we have a question to ask you. You know, we're doing this thing. You know, you're going to have to pose nude. Like, are you okay with that? And, you know, they're like, well, we can have... I forgot what it's called, like intimacy coach there and, you know, make sure you robe and you're not walking around and things of that sort. So, you know, I knew what it meant to pose nude in this magazine for, you know, for Men's Health. It's helping other men who are, who suffer with body issues to get them to really understand that your body is the only body that you have. And it's okay. There's no need to beat yourself down because that's what the world is going to do to you anyway.
And And I don't want to pile on Men's Health, but let's be honest. They have been part of perpetuating this idea that there is an ideal body that everyone should be going for. I mean, when you look at the typical Men's Health cover, that is often what they're projecting.
Yes. And I even offered that. That's not just Men's Health. I think this is media.
Yeah.
Name me a plus size superhero.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love this topic of conversation. And I want to shout out my mom, Mary, who recently started running. They have an underwater track at the health center near her home. And she started running underwater. So I want you to give advice. She wants to take it to land now. And my mom has always dealt with weight issues. And she was like, oh, I can't be a runner. And I'm like, then this popped up and I'm like, yes, you can. I would love for you to give her some advice about just taking it from the water to the land and in her late 60s, picking up running for the very first time.
So what I would tell Mama Dukes is that.
And people call her that on the regular, so that's cool.
Mama Dukes. There's a few things like, so of course you're walking all in the water. You know, take it to the treadmill. There is a specific treadmill and certain like physical therapy clinics have this or even gyms. It's called an Ultra G. And basically what it is a treadmill that you can like reduce your body weight. So like you get into it and like it's like air based and it kind of like reduces the percentage of your body weight while you're walking on a treadmill. So that's one of the things that you could potentially do is find a place that has like an Ultra G and start there. Maybe start with 60% of her body weight or 40% of her body weight and start to build up from there. And then once you start to get comfortable with just running on a treadmill herself, then she can take that from the treadmill to running on the road.
Interesting. Well,
meeting people where they are.
Absolutely.
I love it.
It's fantastic and it's fascinating. And Martinez Evans, thank you so much for the time on Studio 2. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And Martinez Evans, by the way, is the founder of the Slow AF Run Club and the author of a new book called Slow AF Run Club, The Ultimate Guide for Anyone Who Wants to Run. Stick with us here on Studio 2. After the break, we are talking about Jurassic Park.
This is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
This summer, Avi, marked 30 years since the release of Jurassic Park. I'm getting old, but I remember it was a big moment in movie history and in science history.
It was indeed. Jurassic Park was a watershed moment for paleontology, exposing a whole new generation of kids to the wonder of dinosaurs. And Penn paleontologist Ali Nabavizadeh was one of those kids, and I spoke with him recently about the legacy of the film and the way that it changed him.
I just remember just staring up at the screen just in like awe the entire time.
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
So the first big scene with a big long-necked dinosaur, the Brachiosaurus, that hooked me from the get-go. I'm a sucker for the big herbivores and things like that. So that one, the Triceratops, just seeing those on screen with, you know, this new technology that hasn't really been delved into before, you know, you feel like you're seeing real dinosaurs. And yeah. I feel like that was what really kind of hooked me into wanting to learn more about them. And
you were off.
That was it. Yeah.
That was the movie's impact on you. It set you off on your career path, which is amazing to think. Something at 6 years old could do that. Reflecting back now, what was the impact of the movie on the field of paleontology in general?
So it had a huge impact on paleontology as a whole. I mean, before that, this is kind of at a time where a few years earlier, something called the dinosaur renaissance happened, right? So before, dinosaurs were always thought of as these lumbering, hissing, big, huge creatures that just kind of plopped around on Earth. But in the 80s, a bunch of discoveries were made that basically suggested the dinosaurs were warm-blooded. They were a lot more active. The predatory lifestyle of the carnivores was really active. And
they were more interesting.
They were a lot more interesting than people thought. Well, than the general public thought, anyway. And so more research was kind of conveying that. More discoveries were happening at that time. And so with it came this book by Michael Crichton called Jurassic Park. And not too long after is when this movie came out.
It's a dinosaur. Uh-huh.
Not only were kids exponentially excited about dinosaurs and paleontology in general, but it led to museums talking a lot more about dinosaurs and more paleontologists having more interaction with guests to talk about them. And from then on, it just kind of took off.
You mentioned that the creators of the film took great pains to depict dinosaurs, if not how they were, at least a reasonable facsimile of how they were. 30 years later, do those depictions still hold up? Are some of them now, I suppose, outdated based on what we know?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say pretty much every one of them, there has been a lot of updates on what we know about the animal. So, for instance, Velociraptor or the Maniraptorans, they call them in general, they would have had feathers. So they wouldn't look like big reptiles that ran on two legs. They would have basically looked like birds, but 6 foot tall, 9 foot long birds.
They're key characters in the film.
Key characters in the film. The big long neck Brachiosaurus. Very, very good depiction. I still love that depiction. I think it's pretty much almost all correct.
So some have changed radically and some are still
exactly,
pretty close.
Exactly.
And I didn't ask this directly, but you did kind of mention it. Mm-hmm. That opening scene, that is your favorite scene in the film still today, or do you have a favorite scene?
My favorite scene is the Triceratops, the sick Triceratops.
Oh, yeah, she was like my favorite when I was a kid. Now I see she's the most beautiful thing I ever saw.
My favorite dinosaur of all time has always been Triceratops, the horned dinosaur. And a lot of my research has to do with them and a lot of things that are related to them. and how they ate. So I've been very attached to that animal all my life. It's been my favorite ever since I was a kid.
Explain why.
I just thought it was just an incredible looking creature. It's like, can you imagine this 30-foot long animal with a 10-foot long skull with huge spikes jutting out of its head and a parrot beak? It's how bizarre yet amazing is that, you know?
Bizarre,
it's
and majestic.
Majestic, exactly. That is the perfect word for it. Bizarre and majestic. Bizarrely majestic.
Bizarrely majestic.
I just fell in love with that animal, and since then I was like, did it actually look like that? We have the skull, we have the skeletal material, but we don't have soft tissue. So I'm really interested in reconstructing the soft tissue and the muscles and the skin and things like that. How exactly would that have looked on top of the bones that we know of today?
How do you do that kind of projection? What technology is available to us, and what is the process like?
Oh, there are numerous ways you could do it. From a basic comparative anatomy standpoint, you know, you look at living animals today that are closely related. So crocodiles, birds, lizards, a little bit further back. For instance, the musculature. I look at jaw muscles, so I can dissect the muscles of the head of these animals to see where do they attach in the skull, and can I translate that to where they would attach in the skulls of these dinosaurs? Mm. That includes, do they have the same structure in the skull in the first place? Does it have some kind of a marking on the skull, like striations or like kind of a divot where the muscles would have attached? All these things are still preserved in the fossil. Sometimes you get mummified remains, so dinosaur specimens with preserved skin. So you can actually see the scales on some of these animals and see how that would have been distributed on the body.
It's so intricate. Yeah. It almost sounds like forensics.
Yeah.
Mixed with doing a puzzle. I mean, it sounds like you're looking at the tiniest little thing and extrapolating off of that tiny little observation.
Absolutely. Sometimes it's you have the bare minimum of of data you can come up with, and you can still say, okay, what can I do with this one tooth?
Can I ask you about the book? It's called Dinosaur Feeding Biology.
Yes.
Can you extract maybe one or two anecdotes, details from this book that tell us something fascinating about how dinosaurs ate and what their eating apparatus looked like?
Yeah. Something that's near and dear to my heart is the herbivores. So looking at transitions in how their teeth and jaws look, and both the horned dinosaurs like Triceratops and the duck-billed dinosaurs evolved these really, really complex tooth batteries, basically stacks and stacks of teeth that are compressed against each other, over 1,000 teeth.
1,000 teeth?
Yeah, at once in the duck-billed dinosaurs. And they create this huge surface in which the teeth can occlude and grind up really tough material and take in really hard pressure.
Can I ask you, do you ever get caught up in the why of paleontology? Beyond just mere curiosity, do you think there is purpose to trying to solve these puzzles about what dinosaurs looked like and acted like?
This is a question I get asked all the time. And what I always tell people is there's a lot that you can learn from just the ecology of dinosaurs that lived from 250 million years ago to 66 million years ago. That's a long time. And within that time, these animals evolved crazy diversity. There's something to say about that. The only thing that killed them off is this big asteroid that just like basically stopped their evolution except for birds. And there are lots of parallels you can make between the herbivores of the past and things like elephants and giraffes of today. Mm. And there's a lot that can be said about paleoclimatology. Climates changed throughout that time. So how did the animals change? How did what they were doing with their environment change? How did the ecology between predator and prey, how did that fluctuate? There's a lot that can be learned from that.
Like little case studies and adaptation.
Absolutely. Yeah. Case studies and adaptation just from the fossil record.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Ali, for taking some time to talk with us on Studio 2.
Thank you so much. This was great.
And by the way, Ali is the co-author of a new book called An Illustrated Guide to Dinosaur Feeding Biology. That is it for our show today. Producers Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Al Banks is our engineer, and we had special assistance today from Mary Cummings Jordan. For more of our show, head to whyy.org/studio2. I have some voice left. You can download us wherever you get your podcasts. This is Studio 2 from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thanks for joining us.